Thank you for your kind invitation to be with you tonight and to spend a little while talking about something Jeff probably wasn't going to talk about. Tonight I want us to kind of let our minds run forward a year. Just from this point till the last Sunday in December of 2013. I want us to let time just kind of zip through. And I want us to get to the other end of the year, and I want us just for a moment to look back on this year. And I want us to imagine for just a moment that on that particular Sunday, we sit and we look around and we notice that the crowd is much, much larger than it was the first week of January this year as we began. And I want us to imagine for just a minute, why might that be so? What has changed things to the point that instead of like 90% of the congregations of the churches of Christ, as we're sinking in number, we look at the end of this year and all of a sudden we realize that our numbers are larger than they have been in a long, long time. If I turned to each one of you that day and said, why do you think we're here? Why do you think we have more this Sunday than we did beginning of the year? There's almost 50 more people here. Why do we have this many more? What do you think has caused that? It would be a marvelous discussion if we could just run up there and sit down and have that conversation looking back on the year and its successes, because then we would know how to start at the beginning of the year. They say to us that experience is the best teacher, that hindsight is 20/20. Well, how can we kind of get ahead of that curve? And how can we get on the other side of where we need to be and figuring out how we're going to get where we really want to be? It is sad, but it is true, that among churches of Christ today, our numbers are ebbing ever lower and lower and lower. But I don't know that we should despair if you're really interested in comparing yourself to many of the other faiths, because as a whole, we are finding it to be difficult to hold on to the ground that we have begun. That marvelous illustration that we get, that straight is the gate and narrow is the way that leadeth to life, and few there be that find it, and broad is the gate and wide is the way that leadeth unto death, and many there are who enter therein, is so applicable. And I want us to begin with tonight to realize that it's been that way all along. I've had people tell me all the time, I just want to be like the New Testament churches, where you pull out your letters and your epistles to the churches and read about them and see if you really do. Because when you begin to study and read, if you want to flip over to Revelation and study those congregations there mentioned with their goods and their bads and their evils, you sit down and look at them, and what you're going to find is every one of them, save one, had problems that needed to be worked on and discussed. If you want to look through the epistles and look back and see what you find there, you will find within the early New Testament churches the same struggles that you and I find in our church families today. And number one, that ought to be encouraging to us, because it means we're not that far behind, Larry. It means that we're not much different from the folks that were back then, but it also ought to be educational for us. And that we can look and study those churches and find out what their struggles were and kind of be braced for the struggles that we're going to have. But tonight I want to just kind of offer a simple solution. And I want to kind of give you a hint at what I really believe would make a difference in the number of people that sit in these pews at the end of the year and how it might be different from the first of the year. It's my observation, and I am in and out of dozens and dozens of church families a year. Whether it's doing grief workshops, or whether it's doing gospel meetings, or whether it's doing a summer series or a fall series or a winter series or a fill-in for somebody who ends up being sick or whatever the situation. In dozens of church families a year. And I see all kind of interesting things out there. And I'm able to be a part of so many different aspects of church work and church growth. And one of the things that most of the guys agree with me when I mention is that the core of our congregation meets on Sunday night. The core of our congregation meets on Sunday night. If it's going to be done, for the most part, those who are faithful enough to be here on Sunday night, the majority of whom will return on Wednesday night, are the ones that are going to get it done. I don't think there's anywhere that I've been that 25% of the congregation don't do 90% of the work that's done. And there are a lot of reasons for that. Maybe too young, maybe too old to do certain aspects of the work. Maybe a new Christian still trying to take in just the rudiments, the basics of being a child of God. But over the years, we find that there is that core number that is busy about doing the Lord's work. But I do believe that I see most everywhere I go a very sense of complacency toward those who are lost. Toward those who are lost. And I think that comes sometimes from the frustration that we have in trying to reach those who are lost. And whenever I really get plagued with that, I have to think back to the parable of the sower. And I have to remember that, yes, if you look at the souls that we're dealing with, for the most part, the work that we do may not return 30-fold, 60-fold, 90-fold, 100-fold. As a matter of fact, most of the work that we do may be like the deer food plot I planted out at behind the cemetery at home this year. I went out and I worked that ground up and I got it all fixed up and ready to go. And I plant two or three different things, but the thing that I was most interested in one end of that field was to get a good stand of winter wheat. And I went in and planted it nice and thick, fertilized it fairly well. I don't hunt out there. That's where I send my friends, Jeff, who need a place to hunt. I save most of the fertilizer for where I hunt, and I wouldn't tell my friends that. But when I got it all planted, it just jumped up and looked marvelous and wonderful. And I went by one day and I looked and I thought, well, it's not growing very fast. About 2 weeks later, I came back and I said, it's gone. And I never dealt with those little army worms before. I never had those things on anything that I have ever planted. But they ate 2 acres of wheat to the ground in about 11 or 12 days. Unbelievable what they did to it. And you and I know from our experiences working in growing a church family or in growing our own families that many, many times we put in lots and lots of work. And the next thing we know, the grain that we've planted that may have sprouted has slipped away. Paul Rogers used to call it, I find myself spending so much of my time spinning tops, trying to keep tops spinning, trying my best to keep those who are members of the body of Christ faithful. And Paul says it's good for me because it keeps me from getting overly discouraged myself. Because I hear so many things from those that I work with, trying to keep the top spinning, trying to keep them coming, trying to keep them involved, trying to keep them faithful. that it's good for me because it helps me to be reminded that I need to look at where my feet are going, what my hands are doing, what my eyes are seeing, what my ears are listening to, and what my lips are speaking. Because it is truly very easy for a minister to get discouraged. But Paul listens to the lives of those that he's trying to help along the way. And he is reminded that some of what he is doing well. But there comes a time in the spinning of these tops when a top ought to have enough of its own energy that it spins itself. I mentioned a moment ago, as newborn babes desire the sincere milk of the word that you may grow thereby. Why? Because if a little fella stayed a little fella when he should be a big fella, we'd realize there was something wrong with a little fella. And there has to come a time when you and I, as God's children, step out on the limb of our own. There has to come a time in our lives when those who have given us the word have the right of expectation that we would share the word. And that's what I want to mention tonight. I want us to think about what a difference it might make in this church family if we got beyond the complacency about people being lost. If we really and truly became interested again in those who are lost. If we really took it upon ourselves to reach out to those who have not grown up churched, who have not grown up knowing the difference between right and wrong, or having an example to help them with the right and the wrong things of life. In the jail ministry in Centerville, we spend a lot of time behind bars. I mean, and that is literally true. We're there about three times a week, if you look at the various things that we have going on. And we're in among those. Normally I do A and B pod, and the two other guys do C and D pod, and we have just a group of about four men who go there almost every time the doors are open, and then they alternate the rest of us and let us be the speakers as they just kind of oversee what goes on. One of the most interesting days that I spent was talking to these men about what they had as examples growing up and what they saw and what they were a part of and how they were given the opportunity to learn the difference between right and wrong. And honestly, there's about a 50-50 split. 50% of them had no one who cared, no one who gave them direction, according to what they shared with me. No one who really helped them understand the difference between what is right and what is wrong. I'm amazed when we go in and we ask the question, how many of you own a Bible? And how many times we get the response, "Oh, I've never owned a Bible. It's never been in my house. It was never in the house when we grew up. I just don't know about a Bible." But one of the things that I find from those young men is how hungry they are for it. Now, they're not made to come, and one of the rooms that we go into has the dining tables up here, and that's where we sit, and the bunks are back there. And on any given Sunday afternoon when we're there to spend the time with them, about half will sit at the tables. And the rest of them will either sleep or stay in the bunks. But I will share this with you. And I told APOD last week, I said, it amazes me how interested you all are in what we have to say, whether you believe it or not. I deeply appreciate the honor and the respect that you show when we come. And after it was over with, one of the young men came up to me and he simply said, "I've just never heard this stuff you're talking about before." And when you're talking about building your house on the rock, very obvious when I look at my life, I've been building my life on the sand. But no one's ever told me about the rock. And I thought to myself, how many people in our communities truly do not know about the rock. It's very easy for us to become complacent because we seek out our families. We may seek out the people we work with. We may seek out the people who look like us and who dress like us and who think like us and who act like us. But it is a different thing when it comes to seeking out those who are lost. Some of the most active Christians that I know in our church family in Centerville are people who were truly lost and then found the Word of God, the forgiveness of Christ, to be their salvation. You see, part of what we have today is we have homegrown churches. You know, if we went around just kind of asking how many of you had parents who brought you to church, and it was the Church of Christ, and then your grandparents and your great-grandparents, and how many of your children, basically what we've done is we've just grown up churches where there was a period of time when we went out and built churches, knocked on the doors, checked on our neighbors. So that's what I just want to challenge you to think about tonight. How can we invite them in? Flip over with me to that. It's a very simple parable that we've studied and learned about and read about for years and years. The description's quite obvious. We begin in Luke chapter 14 and verse 12. Well, I'll tell you what let's do. Let's just go back and begin in verse 7, because I really think it sets the stage for what comes on in just a minute in verse 15. Verse 7 is a parable of Christ, and it's basically about a wedding feast. And in their tradition, where you were seated at a feast indicated how important you were. If there was a head table and you were seated there, you were one of the important invited guests. You know, speaking at a lot of banquets, I can assure you it's not always a good thing to be seated at the head table. I was at the University of Tennessee addressing somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,500 or 1,600 people who were there for this very special gathering of livestock owners from all over the country, and I was the banquet guest speaker that night. And I'll never forget, I was on the third tier. There was the top tier, the next tier, and the bottom tier, and then all you peons were sitting out there on the floor, you know. That was the kind of the way that they made me feel. And we had to go up a little bit, and it's not that the tables were totally above each other. It was just stair step, probably 2 or 3 feet. And I'm sitting up there on the head table, and they had these huge baked potatoes and these huge steaks. And I did have to make a comment, since basically it was cattle production that they were there for. I did have to make a comment how good the pork steak was that we had for dinner, and that got kind of a murmur from the crowd that was there. But when I sat down, the lady came around with the butter. And I said, "Yes, ma'am, I'd like to have some butter." And she came over and she put one pat of butter in my large baked potato. And I said, "Ma'am, I'd like to have another pat of butter for my baked potato." And she said, "One patty for each potato." And I said, "Ma'am, wait just a minute, you don't understand." And she said, "What do I not understand?" I said, "Ma'am, I have traveled many, many miles to get here. They invited me many, many, many months to come because I am the speaker for these many, many people who are gathered here. So I'm a very important person tonight, and because I am who I am, I would like 2 pats of butter." And she said, "Oh, you're the one who doesn't understand." I said, "Okay." She said, "I am the lady who passes out the butter, and you get 1 pat of butter And she turned and went right on down the table. Now, that is a story that's not true. What actually happened was they brought my baked potato and set it on my plate, and I went to cut my steak, and I hit my baked potato when my knife flew through, and I rolled my baked potato off my plate across the table hard enough that it hit the floor underneath me between the other guys that are there, rolled off the table, hit the floor, the table down there, and rolled out in the floor. And they looked back and said, "Whose potato is this?" I never said a word. I just ate my steak and went right on. But the point is taken in both illustrations. Number one, the guy that sits at the head table is no more important. The man who's standing in the last seat in the house in the eyes of the Lord. It's not a matter of class or place or position. It's not a matter of prestige or pauperism. It's a matter. It is a matter of the soul of the man. And number two, there's always a warning to those who are in a leadership position that you just be very careful, that you do not shipwreck your faith because there are those who are following in your footsteps. So when we begin talking about this particular passage, the first part is just talking about those who wanted a very proud place to sit. When you're invited by anyone to a wedding feast, do not sit down in the best place, lest one more honorable than you be invited by him, and he who invited you and him come and say to you, "Give place to this man. Get up. You're not supposed to be sitting here. This is for some of the higher-ups." And then you begin with shame to take the lowest place. But when you are invited, go and sit down in the lowest place, so that when he who is invited comes, he may say to you, "Friend, go up higher." Then you have glory in the presence of those who sit at the table with you. For whoever exalts himself will be abased, and whoever humbles himself will be I love that word. Whoever humbles himself will be exalted. It's interesting that most of these conversations occur in front of the Sadducees and Pharisees, isn't it? Trying to help them understand the relationship between God and man. And it's not necessarily a relationship of hierarchy. It is a relationship of unconditional love. That's what you and I need to work toward. No matter who it is that we look at, no matter what they have, no matter what they drive, no matter what they wear, unconditional love must be where we start. The second thing out of that we must realize is very simply this. For any man to be loved unconditionally is going to require a level of forgiveness. For God to love us in the way that He loves us, the very basis of that is He's ready to forgive. He is ready to forgive. And when you and I begin to go out in the hedges and highways and we knock on the door and we invite them to come in, you and I better be ready to forgive. Because that is the very premise of inviting someone to the feast of Christ. He also told them who invited him, "When you give a dinner or a supper, do not ask your friends, your brothers, your relatives, your rich neighbors, lest they also invite you back and you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed because they cannot repay you, for you shall be repaid at the resurrection of the just." And then he goes into this particular parable. It's the parable of the great supper. "A certain man gave a great supper and invited many and sent his servant at supper time to say to those who were invited, 'Come, for all things are now ready.' But they with one accord began to make excuses. The first said, 'I bought a piece of ground, I must go and see it. I ask you, have me excused.' And another said, 'I bought 5 yoke of oxen and going to test them. I ask you, have me excused.' Still another said, 'I've married a wife and therefore I cannot come.' That I understand. So that the servant reported these things to his master. And then the master of the house, being angry, said to his servant, Go out quickly into the streets and lanes of the city, and bring them in here, the poor and the maimed and the lame and the blind. The servant said, Master, it is done as you commanded, and still there is room. And the master said to the servant, Go out into the highways and hedges and compel them to come in, that my house may be filled. The parallel between the Jews who had rejected Christ and the Gentiles who were going to be given the opportunity to receive Christ is very obvious in this parable if you just want to pull something out and look at it, because they had rejected the chief cornerstone. They had turned their back on the Messiah. They had not listened to the very own prophecies that were made. And they were just not interested, even though from the very beginning, through the Old Testament, they had been invited to look for the one who was coming. And when he came, they rejected him. So he's saying, go out and beat the hedges and highways down and find out who will come in. Find out who will come in. And I will say to you that if you're having a dinner, it's most easy to get those to come in who are hungry, those who are thirsty, those who are struggling to make ends meet. And if you and I would just kind of take a look at this, go out and compel them to come in. Bring the halt, the lame. Bring those who are having struggles and difficulties, and let them sit at my dinner feast and eat. It hasn't been that long ago that we sat down and we looked at our benevolence program in Centerville. The elders got together. Some of us had a little bit of about the edge of it. And it was amazing when we began to sit down and look back over the years of our benevolent program, how neglectful we had been in seizing the opportunity that was set before us. It was so easy for us to invite folks in and have nice secondhand clothing ready for them to go through and pick out and use. It was easy for us to repair furniture and have furniture for them to use. It was apparently very easy for us to literally make handmade quilts for those who needed warmth. It was very easy for us to have a food pantry that was just stocked with food. And it was amazing to me how difficult it was for us to tell them why we were giving it to them. They thought it was a place to come get what you wanted, and it was. But we should have understood that it was also a place to invite them to sit down at the king's table. We did the worst job of doing that we could have done. I don't know that we ever took the list of the people that came in, because we took a list. And I don't know that we ever took that list of people and went to their door and knocked on their door and asked them if they'd like to have a Bible study. I don't know if when our meetings came, we ever went and knocked on the door and invited them to come to the meeting. I will tell you this. When the program first started, that was done every time somebody came to the door. But we became very complacent. And some way or other, we thought be warmed and be filled was all that we needed to do. And we watched the response to our benevolent program slide to the side. Now, if you call and need a box of food, you will find material to read if you want to. But you will not be able to open the box that's there without an invitation to worship with us, without an invitation for a Bible study, without knowing that we give you this box of food in the name of Jesus, our Savior and your Lord. It's amazing to me how easy it was to do the other, and how hard it is to share the name of Christ. When Joy and I were kids, back in our 20s, we lived in the ghetto apartments at Lipscomb. And they were just off the campus, 1506 Belvedere Drive. Our kids ask us on Christmas morning a series of questions. And whoever got the question right got that particular gift. And they had a whole box of them. And they said, what was the address of the first home you all set up housekeeping in? And Joy said, I don't remember that. Your dad won't, because he never remembers anything. 1506 Belvedere Drive, give me the prize. So I got the prize. One night, it was January, it was cold as it could be. There was a knock on our front door. This very handsome young man, it looked to me like he was probably 7th grade, 8th grade. A young African-American boy, athlete, for sure, just looking at him, you could tell it. And he is standing at our front door in a shirt with sleeves about this long, in a pair of blue jeans, and in a pair of tennis shoes. And his little nose is just running up a storm. And he knocked on the door, and he had a sheet, and he said, Mister, would you like to buy a box of candy? We're raising money for the community center. I said, son, you're freezing. You just get in this house. We opened the front door of the house. We brought him in, and he said, thank you. I said, how long have you been doing this? Since I got out of school. I said, it's 8 o'clock. Have you had anything to eat? No, sir. How would you like a cup of hot chocolate? Oh, I'd love one. And Joy went and got a cup of hot chocolate, and she watched how quickly it went down, and she ended up making a little pot of hot chocolate, and she came and set it down. And she said, now, we've already eaten supper, but I have a little left over if you'd like some. Are you sure it's not too much trouble? No, it's not too much trouble, son. That little boy sat down at that table, and Joy fed him everything we had in the refrigerator. It was anything she needed to get rid of, it went right out the front door when he left. And it's not that we wouldn't have eaten it. It's just that it was leftovers, because honestly, there wasn't that much new stuff ever there. We got him fed, and we looked at him, and we said, we're college students, and we're married, and we don't have enough money to get to the end of the month. And honestly, we can't afford to buy one of your boxes of candy right now. And he looked at me and smiled, and he said, oh, you've given me something much better than candy. You've warmed me up and invited me into your home. And I thought to myself, I can't send the young'un out the door knowing that he's going to be cold the rest of the night. And I went back in the bedroom, and I went through, and I found the warmest sweater that I owned. I can still see it. It was green, and if you see me out running around, you will see me in a turtleneck sweater, because I wear them all the time. Old school, I know, but I still like turtleneck sweaters. I went and I got that turtleneck sweater. It was green. It had white trim on the edge of the collar, and it had white trim down on the cuffs. And I said, son, I don't know that this is going to fit you, but I'd love for you to have it and wear it home. His eyes lit up like a Christmas tree. I reached down and I took that thing and I held that sweater upside down, and he dove into it. I mean, he just went like this, and I took it and I shucked it up him and I pulled it down. And when I pulled it up, sleeves were about that much too long. And I said, man, I wish I had one that's your size. And he said, no, sir. This is fine. Well, I took those sleeves and I rolled them up and I pulled them back down, cuffed them up for him. So he kind of had double armor, you know, on his arms. And I started fixing his collar, and he said, no, sir, I'm not going to turn it down. I'm going to turn it up like this. And when he turned my collar up, it went over his ears, over his nose. He looked like a turtle peeking out of his shell. And I said, I sure wish we could buy you some of your candy. And he said, no, sir, what you've done for me is worth so much more than buying my candy. And he said, mister, I'll never forget you and your wife. And they closed the door, and he walked out. And, you know, I've often wondered what happened to that young man. But, you know, the thing that I am most ashamed of is that not one time when I was with him did I mention the name of Christ. Not one time did I tell him about my Jesus. Not one time did I try to find out where he lived so I could go by and pick him up and take him to church. Not one time did I give him a peg to hang my kindness on in knowing where it came from and why it was really done. I'm going to tell you this, and I believe it with all of my heart. If between now and next December, this church family won't let that happen a single time, I believe you will see a difference in the number of people that are sitting in these pews. I believe that. I believe that if you'll just let your light shine with the opportunities that you have, you won't have to go out looking. But if you'll go out looking, you'll double the possibilities. I love muscadines. I've got a little muscadine vine that grows in my yard. And every year, I get about a quart and a half of muscadines off of that. But there's never enough there or jam or jelly. If I want muscadine jelly, then I got to go out and find them somewhere else. But let me tell you this. I never miss getting the muscadines that are at home. And I think every month of our lives, we allow people's souls to slip through our fingers just because we don't seize the opportunities that we have to bring them here. You know, it's really hard sometimes to invite people to come to church because sometimes that's uncomfortable. But you all are having a devotional. Is it this Friday night? Open to the entire congregation. Now, how many of your friends would enjoy going with you to spend a little time in someone's home? We have just found that that's one of the best times in the world to invite people. It's when we're having a devotional. We have a group of, we call them the 20-somethings. They're 20 to 30, and it just thrills me to be able to tell you we have 60-plus young people in that age bracket that worship with us in Centerville. But we work very, very, very hard at that group. But you know how we've grown that group? It's through their devotionals and them inviting their friends to come find out what we do. And we may not tell them it's a devotional. We may tell them we're going to watch a ball game, because we are. Matter of fact, tomorrow night, y'all come. And they're going to bring all their buddies, and they're going to watch that national championship game. And at halftime, they're going to turn off the TV, and they're going to break the bread of life with those who are there. It's not that tough. If we'll just open our eyes and if we'll see the opportunities, Jeff will preach to them. But it's your love that will get them here to hear the preaching. And it's your willingness to sit and listen that will change their lives for eternity. Because Jesus so simply said in his own words, go and teach all nations. He said, you're already the light of the world. And you can't let your light be hidden. But you need to put it on a stand. And you know what that means? That means just let people know why your light shines. They're already going to see you. But if you can let them know why you do what you do, it will make all the difference in their lives and their perception of you and this church family. That's that little bitty simple Luke 14 go out into the hedges and highways and invite them in. When we have our youth program, our fifth quarters after all the high school basketball games, after all the high school football games, our Saturday Night Lives, where we just invite kids from the neighborhood to come in, we get their names. Craig follows up with every one of them, and we try our best to make a contact with that family to let them know who is taking care of their kids. It's had a marvelous impact on those who are part of what we do. But 35 visitors have been in our church building since December the 15th. And I cannot tell you if a one of them had been contacted by anybody other than our minister. And as an elder of the Centerville Church, I am embarrassed to tell you that. I'm embarrassed to say that. Well, I do know that a fellow elder, Mike Goodpaster, writes everyone that comes in a handwritten letter and an invitation to come back. What would it be if when a visitor from this community walked into this church building, if 25 of you sent a letter of encouragement thanking them for being here and inviting them to come back? What would happen if the second time they walked in this building, some of you said, "Why don't you go eat lunch with us today? There's just three or four of us going out, and we'd love to have you go with us." What kind of difference would it make? How hard is that? It's not that hard if we'll just do what Christ did, ask us to do, which is let our light shine. I appreciate you letting me come tonight. We started 3 minutes late. If we sing an invitation song and we have a closing prayer, we'll be out on time. I thank you for listening. I thank you for allowing me to come, Jeff. I hope all of us, just once in a while, will take a look at those around us and see who we might be able to reach out to. It might be that there's someone here tonight that has been thinking about taking that step that will begin that walk. That person might be here because one of you has brought them. It might be that some of you have kind of lost the direction. You want to kind of start anew. We'd love to have you come. We'd love to bury you into baptism if you haven't been baptized for the remission of your sins in order that you can be raised to walk in a new life. Or if you've lost your footing, you've lost your home, it's right here waiting. Come back and we'll pray for you as well. Or if there's just a need that you have that this church family needs to know about, we'd invite you to come as we stand and as we sing.